And we welcome you into a Friday edition of Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Nick Braden, D-Mace, Marquise, good to have you in here on a Football Friday. Boys, what's going on? How's everybody feeling this morning?
Oh, so good to be back and see you guys, all your shining faces. So wonderful.
Bald shining heads?
I love all the bald shining heads, the shiny domes. Nice to see you guys.
All right, what's better? The Golden Dome of Notre Dame on a Saturday night under the lights in Athens, or Derek Mason and Nick Cale's bald heads in the bright light studios of 102.5 The Game.
No question, it's the two of you.
That's what I thought.
More history and prestige with you two, I think, than
the
Notre
bright
Dame.
Light.
Also, you guys have competed for more championships at a higher level, I think, in the last two decades.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's a no-brainer. It's the two of you. Does this make me a bad parent? That I don't want to spend the entire day with two children without the support and help of my wife. Again.
No.
Does that make me a bad parent?
It makes you a father with two daughters that admits he's overwhelmed at times.
And the thing is it's not overwhelming.
It was for me.
It's just such a grind. Like, so I was home yesterday. Thank you guys for carrying the ship yesterday without me. With two hand, foot, and mouthers at home, but two Noah Syndergaards at the house yesterday, and they're totally fine. They didn't have any more symptoms, and the fevers were like all the stuff was gone, but they still couldn't go back to daycare, so I had to stay home and take care of them yesterday. And you just have to live like a 12-hour day in like 15-minute increments to try to keep two kids under three occupied, busy, engaged. Whatever, like I got to nap time and I just sat down and I was like, oh my God, I've been going for 6 hours.
Oh yeah.
It was 6 a.m. to noon before they got to nap and I was like, oh.
Don't worry, there's relief coming. When they get to 4.5, 5 years old.
They can start entertaining themselves
They can do all their things by themselves and you can take a nap in peace. And they might be fighting when you wake up, but they're not going to kill each other.
Right, exactly. I see parents like walking down the street, not a single parent, but like a parent who is alone. With like three kids that are like a little bit older, you know, like a 10-year-old, a 8-year-old, and a 6-year-old or something. And like they all stay on the sidewalk when they walk. And I'm going, what's that like? What's that like to have children that follow your orders and that you can go places with them by yourself and they will follow along with what you're saying? Like they are regular humans in society. They know how to function in society. And mine do not understand that yet. I mean, one of them, hell, can't even talk yet. But that's part of the problem. She can't communicate what she needs. She just screams about it. I'm like, okay.
All right.
I have so much respect for parents that take care of children.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
People that work at daycares, I have so much respect for people like that.
My girls are in kindergarten now, and dude, I'm telling you, I do not know how anybody could be a kindergarten teacher.
Or like these, like the unbelievable people at our daycare that have like 14 3-year-olds. In their class, and it's like two teachers with 14 3-year-olds. I'll tell you what, you people out there who are just gotten married, about to get married, whoever you are, you're thinking about having kids, go tour a daycare. That's either the greatest contraception known to man, or you're assured of your decision, right? Like you'll be like, all right, we're ready for this. We're going to go do this. Having kids, that is. Go tour a daycare. If you think you're ready to have a kid, go tour a daycare.
All right.
And then say to yourself, do I want this?
Good to have you back. Jeremy Pruitt says the show will be 100 times better today.
Oh, man.
In case you guys wanted to hit the rim shot.
Jeremy.
Still JP.
Stop it, Jeremy.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm assuming you guys talked about that a little bit yesterday. I don't know. I was asked about his tenure on a radio hit in Valdosta, Georgia, of all places. And I'm not a big fan of moving on from coaches after 16 games. I think I've made that pretty clear. I don't think that you can accurately evaluate a coach after 16 games in a year and a half. But you could argue that since his opening press conference, he has sounded overmatched for the job.
I think that's fair.
You could say, like, literally every step of the way, since the opening press conference through a Titanic reference earlier in the season, like little gaffes that don't really mean anything, but when you package them with 25-point blowouts every other week, I'm not saying Tennessee should move on the coach. I just think you keep saying stupid stuff, and it sounds bad, and it looks bad, and you've kind of done it for the entire tenure that you've been at Tennessee. I don't know. I don't know if you guys agree with me on that, but I think you can make the case he's sounded overmatched since the first day he took the job.
He does, and we talked about this yesterday, and I'm sure we'll get into it with Josh Ward from Knoxville, but I'm telling you, this is a guy that just thinking about it last night, I'm sitting there watching the Eagles-Packers, and I'm thinking about Jeremy Pruitt's comments. I even said it to my wife. I go, he said that they're 100 times better than they were a year ago, and she goes, and my wife doesn't pay attention to a ton of football other than probably the Eagles in Alabama, and she goes, aren't they really bad this year?
Even she recognized, like, aren't they bad? Like, they're not good this year, are they? So how can they be 100 times better than what they were last year? He's, I'm not going to base any decision upon how he sounds, you know, in front of the mic or at a presser. I think he's a good coach, but at the wrong program. Can he be a head coach somewhere else? Possibly. Yes, I think he could be.
Troy?
But he's not a head coach, I don't think, at the University of Tennessee. Tennessee needs someone with the brain of Lane Kiffin, the energy of Butch Jones.
Or Will Healy.
Let's go with Herm Edwards.
No, just the energy of Butch Jones. I mean, Butch Jones' energy was always high. His recruiting was always high. So if they could get a brain like Lane Kiffin that can put together an offense, if they can get the energy and recruitment like Butch Jones.
Minus
the cliches. Even with the cliches, if you're winning, it works.
Oh, yeah.
Have it all have substance, right? Have there be substance.
If they had that energy and that recruitment, and then someone with just that podium cares, that charismatic, you know, kind of feel in him.
Dabo, Coach O, you know,
then that's the guy that UT needs. I don't know where that guy is at, but that's the guy. maybe it's Will Healy. I don't know. It could be him.
You know, it's funny as I'm hearing you talk about this stuff. It's kind of like what I feel like Titans fans are saying about their quarterback, not to bring everything back to Marcus, but it's like if you could just get a guy who's as tall and as big as Ben Roethlisberger with his arm as good as Tom Brady and like the mental capacity of Peyton Manning, that would be so great if we could just find that at quarterback.
Oh, sure.
Like, yeah, they don't. It's hard to find. They don't grow.
Those coaches I described, they are out there.
There's just
nobody,
not a lot of them, though.
Nobody wants to give them. They all say, well, you need another job before you get our job. Like Will Healy, you need this job before you get that job. Well, you look at Butch, you look at Pruitt, he didn't have to get that job before he got that job. He just had to work with Nick Saban and yada, 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 and yada, yada, yada before he got that big job.
That's part of the problem, though.
That's what I'm saying. And maybe
success by association.
And maybe, just maybe.
No experience being a head coach.
Having the guy that has been a head coach that has proven, keyword proven, he could take a program. No matter how big the program is, he could take a program and turn it into a winning program when for years it's been a losing program.
Yeah, I think athletic directors hiring coaches and NFL teams finding quarterbacks are very similar in that you're just kind of gambling. You're taking guesses on guys to know whether or not they're good enough to handle the job. Like we just Kirby Smart, there was no reason to expect Kirby Smart to be this elite level head coach. Like he was a Nick Saban assistant for 10 years. Nobody knew what his voice sounded like. Basically, like you didn't know if he was going to be great or not. Georgia lucked into him, right? And I mean, they did their diligence and they hired a really high quality coach. And like it turned out, it worked. That's not the usual thing. You don't know. And again, we're kind of taking this one little comment and kind of ballooning it off into this huge conversation. And again, none of us believe that Jeremy Pruitt's comments were literal. I don't think anyone's taking it literally. Like I don't think he meant it literally. I don't think he literally meant that they're 100 times better. It's sort of a figure of speech. The problem is the figure of speech is coming about a team that looks demonstrably worse than a team.
I think he believes it.
And he might. That's what I'm saying.
I think he believes it.
But I don't think. Like I just mean the 100. I don't think he. I don't think he did the math. You know what I mean? but I think it's the same with quarterbacks. Like if you could just find a perfect quarterback out of a laboratory and get him, everybody would have one. But you don't. It's hard to find elite-level head coaches. It's hard to find elite-level quarterbacks. When you hire Kirby Smart, it's just like drafting Mitch Trubisky. You don't know what you're going to get sometimes, and there's a lot of guesswork going on, and it's why the interview process that people don't see from a head coach standpoint or a quarterback standpoint, that's so important, right? Like, you, athletic directors make tons of money to sit in conference rooms and interview candidates and decide whether or not that person's going to be good enough to coach the team. It's not just what you saw on the field and what you see in the stats and what you see on the Wikipedia page. Same thing with the quarterback. There's more to it than that. And so it's, if everybody could do it, everybody would have one. And Tennessee clearly does not have decision makers that know how to do that. Again, we're way over our skis here on Jeremy. Jeremy Pruitt still has plenty of time as the Tennessee head football coach to fix things and to build, rebuild the program. The question is, do we believe that's going to happen?
All right, it's Morning Drive. We are live this morning from the Wholesaling Studio, powered by RumbleOn.com. Here's what we got coming up on the show today. Josh Ward from WNML in Knoxville. He'll join us at the bottom of this hour. Teron Davenport at 7:30 this morning. We've got a lot to do this morning. We're going to get to the Falcons and Titans as well. But speaking of decision makers, how about the decision made last night by former Titans OC Matt LaFleur? We'll get to that coming up next on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Nick Braden, D-Mace, Marquise with you. Thursday night football in the books. Surprisingly, we got a really good game on a short week as the Eagles salvage their season, avoid a 1-3 start. They knock off the previously unbeaten Green Bay Packers. Two things from a local standpoint with this game last night. Eagles defensive end Derek Barnett, former Tennessee Volunteer, according to Adam Schefter, unlikely to be suspended for his hit last night on Packers running back Jamal Williams. Could be fined, but will be sparred a suspension. So he had a really up-and-down night last night of penalties, but also highlight plays. And then, obviously, the Eagles get the win. And Matt LaFleur, can we discuss this? Four straight passes from the one-yard line?
Yeah, and as you're watching it in the moment, I don't think you even notice that it happens. And that is the weirdest thing. Not until after it's over do the announcers say, like, four straight pass plays on the one-yard line. That's kind of strange. And then you start thinking, well, why didn't you run the ball at least one time? Now, they could not run the ball at all last night. The Eagles had done a great job stopping the run, so I understand the hesitancy maybe to go to something that hasn't worked at any point during the night. But the fact that I didn't really, as a Packers fan watching the game, now I had a really long day yesterday, so maybe my brain wasn't working at full capacity, but the fact that it didn't even really strike me as that odd of a decision is probably an indication of where we are as football fans. That how many times do we see a team on 4th-and-1 line up in the shotgun? You know, anywhere on the field, not just goal line, but anywhere on the field, we see them line up in 4th-and-1 in the shotgun, and we're all going, why aren't you under center going quarterback sneak? Like, it happens in college, it happens in the NFL. It's just sort of where we are. Like,
but it feels like it feels so coaching weird. Malpractice. Like, when you have, I'll give you 4th-and-1 at the 35-yard line, you're going for it, you're in that in-between range, too long for a field goal, too short for a punt. But, first and goal at the 1, in a day and age where you have a big, tall quarterback, Tom Brady's always sneaking it like a champ. The Packers actually carry a fullback, not one carry.
I mean, you try to play the odds. You scout yourself, but then you scout the opponent. What does the opponent like to do in these situations? And you try to make your calls based on that. And, you know, whether he tried to throw it, you know, four straight times, or we tried to run it four straight times. Either way, if you don't get in, there's always going to be questions on, why didn't you try to throw the ball at least once? Well, why didn't you try to run the ball at least once? Aaron Rodgers has a great track record inside the 3-yard line with throwing a football. And Matt LaFleur trusts that he will make the right decision. You call plays and you just ask your guys to get open. And, you know, Philly played real good defense on all four of those possessions, and you know it's you're out there trying to play chess, and sometimes you make the wrong move.
So I think the sequence was first and goal fade, then they ran the play action boot where they tried to slip the fullback out, and then two straight plays where they were just, I don't know, some sort of pass play.
Well, and it can snowball on you too, right? Like, you think you're being sneaky and smart by throwing on a first down, but then you don't. It doesn't work, and you go, oh, maybe I need to throw it on second down. Like, you can almost get ahead of yourself in that situation where the scenario builds on itself, and all of a sudden you're in third down, and you're like, well, I can't run it now. Like, I got to throw it now. Like, and you might, maybe it's the third down play. Like, third down probably would have been the one I would have liked to have seen a run on. Go that way, you're setting up, at least on fourth down, you're making the defense consider both options. So that's the one I'd say, hey, I'd like to see them run the ball, maybe on third down. Again, I'm with the basic, though, to what you said, Derek. It's like, who do you want the ball? If you're going to put the ball in somebody's hands in that situation, who do you want it to be? And it's like, well, obviously, you want it to be Aaron Rodgers. Like, that's the guy you want making the decisions with the football, because he's one of the greatest quarterbacks that's ever lived. So I don't, it's weird. Like, again, in the moment, I didn't have a problem with it. It was just so strange that I didn't find myself like screaming, run the football at the television, you know, to no one because my whole family was asleep. Like, I didn't, it was just weird. I was like, we got done with the sequence, and the broadcasters were like, man, they didn't run the football at all there. And I go, oh yeah, they didn't run the football at all. And you just realize that, in the modern NFL, you're going to be in, or college, you're going to be in the shotgun, and you're probably going to throw the ball on third and three. Like, that's a passing down now, and it's just a weird place to be in the NFL or in college.
I'm just thinking of the days. I mean, I don't know how many teams actively carry a fullback in the NFL today, but the Packers do. I remember the days of John Kuhn with the Packers, and before him, back in your day,
Moose Johnston,
William Henderson.
William Henderson. I'm just thinking of fullbacks in general.
Those are good Packer names, though. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, you would throw a fullback back there with the running back. And,
Lorenzo Neal,
you know,
was
the running back. The fullback would leave for the running back. You know, you had two guys that were about the same size a lot of times, a fullback blocking for a running back that weighs maybe 5 pounds less than him. But that era of football is gone. They use fullbacks in different manners now, more so catching the ball than anything. You know, you don't question it. I mean, hell, they put up 30. They put up almost 30 points. Aaron Rodgers, you know, in that passing game looked crisp at times.
Yeah, 400 over 400.
Oh, he had the best game of his season.
And you know, if it wasn't for the interception at the end, that game's going into overtime. And it was a perfect play call. I just think Aaron threw it a little bit. He anticipated it a little bit too quick.
Yeah.
Because had he just held on to the ball for less than a second more, the corner route came wide open, and that would have been a layup for him. So I mean, I don't fault LaFleur. I think he's aggressive, and if his aggressive nature leads to Green Bay being back in the playoffs, I don't think no Packer fan will question what he does as the offensive coordinator.
615-737-1025 is the phone number. So Packers no longer undefeated. But let me just bring this up with LaFleur. Like, I'm watching him last night, and, you know, I try not to, like, judge a book by its cover. But is there an element to me? The notion I got last night is, and it's not just the play calling late in the game. There's a similar Andy Reid feel to Matt LaFleur of smartest guy in the room syndrome, where some of the play calling, even dating back to last year with the Tennessee Titans, where you kind of look at the way he goes about game planning and scheming, and you say, is he, I don't want to say full of himself, but because he doesn't look like he's full of himself, but I mean, I don't even know what the hell I'm saying.
Yeah,
does it make sense as far as the play calling?
Well, there's a handful of guys, and I know the college coaches better, so I'll Dan Mullen is one of the smartest football minds offensively you can ever come across, and he'll tell you about it, right? Like, he's very confident in his abilities, and it's very obvious. Pat Fitzgerald is that way at Northwestern, one of the smartest guys you'll ever talk to, and he'll tell you about it. I don't think LaFleur is cut from that cloth. It doesn't strike me. Again, I don't, you know, be
not from a verbal standpoint,
yeah,
but from a play calling standpoint.
Yeah, he's not that level of arrogant or confident or self-belief or whatever. But I think he, like, again, there's a fine line between trusting what you would do in every situation and being convicted in that, which is sort of what we want Marcus to do, right? We want Marcus to be convicted in his decisions and just do it, right? Just sling it, just pull the trigger. It may lead to more mistakes, but people want him to just do it. I think when Matt LaFleur calls a play, I don't think he ever calls a play thinking, oh crap, this isn't going to work. You know what I mean? Like, there's a confidence in, I think it's going to work because this principle, this philosophy, this scheme, this route combination, this whatever has worked.
Like, sometimes I think the common sense play is there, and he decides to go to something more elaborate when the answer's right in front of him.
Yeah, and I'd need to see, like, specifics on that. Like, if you were like, hey, here's a third and three where a crossing route was wide open, and the coverage indicated that that would work, but instead they went with a deeper, you know, a deeper, longer developing route or something. I would need to see, you know, specifics on that. But does he tend to skew towards the more complicated offense? Yeah, but so does, I mean, if we're comparing him to Andy Reid, you know, Derek, you say this all the time. He's one of the best play callers, designers, schemers in the NFL. If that's the comparison we're making, then I'd be very happy if I'm a Packers fan with the guy who thinks he's the best play caller in the world if he actually can produce big offenses.
Yeah. Beside Bill Belichick, Andy Reid is the best offensive mind in the National Football League. He is. There's nothing that tells me that he's not. Every step that he's been, I mean, Philly, they always had top-ranked, you know, offenses. He goes to, you know, he goes to Kansas City, and he takes Smith, and he turns him around from being, just being a good quarterback to a, you know, a guy that segued himself into a huge contract and was supposed to be sort of the savior of the Washington Redskins. This Andy Reid is, and if you're learning from a guy like Andy Reid, that's great. And if you approach it the way Andy Reid approaches it, then that's great. Because again, I even think, you know, I even think he's better than Bill Belichick at times. But Bill is just all encompassing, offense and defense. But Andy Reid, if you're talking about drawing up a play,
yeah.
If I got one guy to draw up a play and put together an offensive game plan, yep. I'm choosing Andy Reid every time.
I don't have a problem with that. Well, Nick, what was your experience around Andy Reid from that perspective? Meaning,
so many times where you could have just ran the ball and he decided to throw it. But I mean, there was T-shirts in Philadelphia that said "Run the ball."
Oh,
Andy.
He hated running the ball.
He hated running the ball.
He hated it.
But isn't that sort
and that's what I kind of envisioned last night with the floor with not running it from the 1 yard line.
Right, and that makes sense. You're like harkening back to like
because the short passing game to him is an extension of the run.
And that's what I was going to get to is like in 2004. I think that makes sense. Run the ball, run the ball, run the ball.
Offensive. Yeah, no, it's true.
Game plans were different. Defenses were different. Players were different. And today, the rules are so different and the games are so different that, again, third and three is a passing down. And that's really, like, the thing that strikes me more, not that the Packers didn't run the ball, that it didn't even strike me in the moment that they should have run the ball. That's what's so weird. It's like, man, oh, yeah, I guess they should have ran the ball there. And you're going... Well, that's not the way NFL offenses function anymore. A 2 yard pass, like you said, Derek, is the short passing game is the running game now, right? Yep. Like that's the way the game has gone. Tom Brady does it better than anybody.
For sure. All right, let's head up to Knoxville, shall we? Our buddy Josh Ward from WNML is coming up next. The Vols have a bye this week, but we'll delve into all things UT with Josh coming up next on Morning Drive. Welcome back into Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Nick Braden, D-Mace, and Marquise with you as we ship it up to Knoxville here on a Football Friday. Welcome in our buddy Josh Ward from WNML. Josh, happy Friday. How you doing, pal?
Hey, doing well. Great to be with you guys.
Good to have you in. So let's get the reaction, not only from the media in Knoxville, but also the fans. Jeremy Pruitt says the Vols are 100 times better than they were a year ago. How was that perceived in Knoxville?
There were some disagreements with that take. Tennessee fans don't really see it that way. I don't see it that way. I've yet to talk to anybody who sees it that way. But actually, you know, the comment didn't get as much of a reaction as I expected that it might when I heard him say it. It was thrown in the middle of a long answer. Maybe that was part of it. But I think fans are just at such a loss with not only this past Saturday, but what's happened this season, what's happened over a long period of time that the reaction when I heard Jeremy Pruitt say it live did not come the way that I thought from Tennessee fans.
Josh, what is better right now today versus where they were last year at this time going into an Auburn game that they were about to win? What on this team has been improved?
Well, I think you can point to individual parts of the team. Like the offensive line is bigger and I think is better in pass protection, which should help the offense. But then I think another issue you run into is I think there's a lack of discipline maybe at times with the offensive line or different parts. So penalties pop up, and they get in the way of other progress that you've made. And I think not only get in the way, but they set you back from where you are. On the defensive side, I find a difficult time. I think Tennessee has shown the ability maybe to be better with its run defense, but that's also against competition that wasn't going to be very good at running the football. Let's see what they do when Georgia comes down in a couple of weeks and the rest of the competition. Kylan Hill's not going to be easy to go up against. So I think the offensive line is where you would point to first, that it's better in pass protection and there's more potential there. There's more to build on with guys like Darnell Wright and Wanya Morris, players we talked about in the offseason. But the comparison to what Jeremy Pruitt is saying, last year's team, last year's team facing this current team, I would absolutely pick last year's team to beat this team head-to-head. And that's why the 100 times better comment I just can't get behind. Because if you think you see individual progress, and I don't doubt that Jeremy Pruitt sees that, the conversation has to be as a whole with the team, and it's just not there.
Now, I've been a part of a college program at Michigan State where you have a longtime coach in George Perlis, and then all of a sudden they make a change, and in come Nick Saban. And when he comes in, you know, he changes the culture, and in changing the culture, guys quit, guys leave the program, but he get other guys to come. Now you have more guys that are leaving the program at UT. What is really going on with this program? Is it just, you know, the new head coach weeding some players out? They can't take, you know, the total culture change that's going on at UT, which could be a good thing. They're used to what they had when they first came in with Butch Jones. Is it just that, or is it something seriously going on with this program that you're having more and more guys leave?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see how this locker room does over the next few weeks with what's sure to be a bumpy ride, because it makes you wonder, is it going to get worse here? And I've also continued to think about the comments that Jeremy Pruitt made when we were down there in Hoover, Alabama, and he talked about the relationships that he had strengthened with his players, and admittedly said he didn't do a good enough job of that in year one. And I've heard some of that, and maybe Jeremy Pruitt should have done a better job recruiting or establishing relationships with the players that he was inheriting, not just focusing on the players he needed to bring in. Remember the middle of last season on national television. It wasn't just you heard talk. He told us, I've got to go recruit other players. And I wonder if that is something that is coming back to negatively affect him. And I've also heard from Tennessee fans a lot of, well, they've got to move on from these Butch Jones players. Well, when you need a roster of 85, good luck doing that. Because while, like this week, Willie Naughton, Shannon Reed, they are not two of Tennessee's best players, and neither one of them are starters at inside linebacker. But now you've just lost your third and fourth inside linebacker. So now your number three guy is Jeremy Banks, who played running back a month ago. And that presents a serious problem. And also, a lot of the best players, not all of them, because I just mentioned Wanya Morris and Wright as two positives, but a lot of the guys you need to help you get through this are still Butch Jones players. So it has not gone well with the transition from taking over, having Butch Jones players, if we're calling them that, kind of lead the way with Jeremy Pruitt's players coming in to help with the transition. I say it's not going well. That's pretty obvious. I see the 1-3 record and the results there, but I guess I mean that in front of us and what we're seeing, and also what's going on behind the scenes, and that's something they're still continuing to try to fix while they have to enter the toughest stretch of SEC play.
Josh Ward, WNML, is joining us here on Morning Drive. Josh, could you envision a scenario where Jarrett Garantano loses the quarterback position at some point this year?
Could I have imagined that at the start of the year?
Yes.
Yeah, I could not have. I was of the opinion that the one thing Tennessee had to have happen is keeping Garantano healthy, and that if he went down, that this offense could completely break apart. And that's maybe not still wrong, but he has not lived up to what I expected him to be. And I didn't necessarily think he was going to be an all-SEC player or anything like that. I thought that he was good enough last year, and he didn't hurt Tennessee, that you could build on that and he would take a step forward and he would be even better with some of the parts around him better, and it's gone the other direction there. And I still think he has been Tennessee's best quarterback. He just hasn't been a good enough quarterback. So what happens between now and Georgia and Mississippi State, they're trying to get that figured out on the practice field. Jeremy Pruitt talking about splitting up reps evenly. That doesn't necessarily mean evenly with the first team. So I think that Jeremy Pruitt looks at Garantano and says, he's probably our best player at that position. We've got to figure something out to get him fixed. Because while they love the attitude and the approach, the fearless play from Brian Maurer, he does have to be a lot better as well. And being fired up and getting fans excited can only do so much if you don't go out there and perform. So they're just they're at a tough spot, but I don't think Tennessee's coaches want to give up on Jarrett Garantano as much as some of the fans do because of what Tennessee still needs from Jarrett.
But don't you have to learn what you have in the other two guys at some point this year? I mean, if we're talking about a 4-8 season, you have to start planning and preparing and learning for next year already. And, you know, if Jarrett Garantano is not going to be the answer next year, whether it's a freshman or one of these two guys on the roster currently, don't you have to kind of know what you have from those guys this year?
Yeah, I agree with that. I said I would open up competition and on the practice field, especially at this time. I just keep running into the issue in the short term of what you're about to face. And I would get Ryan Bauer prepared to play. I was a little surprised with the way that he was used against Florida. The strength for Brian Bauer right now seems to be his running ability, and he was throwing the ball a lot against Florida, and that didn't go well. So when you talk about, you're right to point out, learning what you have with them, I think they need to do a better job with what they have of them. And is J.T. Shrout still in the equation? Because a couple of weeks ago, Jeremy Pruitt was talking about, well, he'd actually be more of the thrower. And Brian, like, if Garantano went down, my thought was that Shrout would be the guy that they would use more in the passing game, and Maurer as a runner, and that obviously didn't play out against Florida. So I think they're trying to figure it out on the fly. And, you know, that can be dangerous. If they're trying to do that, entering a game with a 1-6 record against South Carolina in a game that you just have to have, because at that point, 4-8 becomes even generous and optimistic. And that's why this next month is just so important in holding things together, trying to improve some broken parts, and trying to figure out what they have for the future as well.
All right, Josh, final one for you. I know we're a month of the way through the season, so it's not a big sample size, but the guy is making $1.5 million per year, the highest paid OC in college football. What has been your evaluation of Jim Chaney?
Yeah, it's not gone great. And a question that I've asked aloud this week as well has been, okay, how involved is he in the meetings, on the practice field when we're not watching because very little is shown to the media? How involved is he with the quarterbacks? Because we know that he's been involved with the offensive line, and he should be, but Chris Winkie is the quarterback's coach, and Winkie's resume is not the best when it comes to quarterbacks, and this season has not helped with that. Jim Chaney's is really good. Jim Chaney is the guy that's making a ton of money. He was the guy that Tennessee invested more than $5 million in to come in and take the offense to the next level. This is on Jim Chaney. Jeremy Pruitt as well is the head coach, but Jim Chaney with the offense. And right now is the time. We've seen him help quarterbacks, and if the right word is fix quarterbacks in the past. He helped with Jonathan Crompton at Tennessee 10 years ago when fans were saying it's time to move on. Lane Kiffin and Jim Chaney stuck with him, and then he did turn things around in the middle of the season. And Nathan Peterman, who left Tennessee, went to Pitt, had success with Jim Chaney. Can he figure that out with Garantano? Can he get a freshman ready to go? Jim Chaney makes enough money for that to be his job, and that's on him to get done here in the next few weeks.
Josh, great stuff as always. We appreciate the time. We'll chat again next Friday.
Hey, you got it. Thanks a lot, guys.
Josh Ward, WNML in Knoxville. How about that? The fact that you have, think about some of the guys on campus right now. You got Jim Chaney, highest paid OC. Chris Wanky, former quarterback. You got T. Martin in the building. I know dealing with other position groups, but you would think that collection of minds would be able to produce something a little bit more efficient, effective.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just a thought.
No, I agree. I don't have much to add to that because there are no answers. I think you need to figure out, again, you've got 2 weeks here to do some soul searching. Obviously, you're not going to search enough to beat Georgia. It's not going to happen. Bama. But, you know, Josh had a lot of positive things to say there about the offense and what they've learned about the offense. The fact that he can't find any positive growth on the defensive side of the ball, Jeremy Pruitt's baby, when you're about to face Georgia's offensive line, Kylan Hill in Mississippi State, Alabama's offense, Ryan Helinski in South Carolina offensively look at least somewhat dangerous. Missouri is very dangerous on offense. You still have a lot of offensive games to play, and your defense hasn't gotten any better. Like, it's, you know, I don't know what to say about that. I think on offense, it's almost like you just have to figure out what JT Shrout or Brian Maurer are. You got to find out what those two guys are in some way, shape, or form because you need to have a better plan in place for next year.
I wholeheartedly agree. 615-737-1025, the number. All right, it's a big weekend coming up for your Tennessee Titans. They are in Atlanta to take on the Falcons, a pair of 1-2 teams desperate to avoid a 1-3 start. We'll delve into the Titans when we come back here on Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. It is Morning Drive, ESPN 102.5, the Sturgill. Nick Braden, D-Mates Marquise.
I believe this album comes out today.
Well, how long has this single been going for? A couple of months now, right?
Yeah, about a month and a half or so. I mean, singles run, I don't know what singles run now. They run a ways out, right? You got to build the hype.
Probably like a couple of months before the actual album comes out. You drop a couple singles, drop a couple bangers, is what we call them.
A couple of bangers. That one's a banger right there, no question. I guess the movie comes out on Netflix. I don't know. Maybe today?
Yeah.
I don't know. I pre-ordered it a long time ago, so it better show up in my damn house today.
I used to drop a bunch of singles and bangers back in the day, but that was before I got married.
Wouldn't that
at the club?
Wouldn't that make you like 11 though, or 12 years old, or something? Didn't you meet your wife at like 14 years old?
Y'all basically got married in eighth grade.
I told you, it's like a modern day Boy Meets World.
Haley was like, "How long has Nick been married?" I'm like, "I think 18 years."
He got married in preschool.
Wait a second, he's 35. Ninth grade they got married. How long have you actually been married?
I got married at 24.
So 11 years.
Yeah, it'll be 11 years this November.
Congratulations.
Yeah. We scheduled it around like before the LSU game, but after the Tennessee game. So it was like, you know, the little cupcake schedule.
See, and I think that actually gives you credibility, because most people that would move from Philadelphia to the South and claim to be Alabama fans, I would say no way they're real fans. I'd say no way they're real. This is just fabricated because Nick Saban's great and you just like bandwagon jumping.
Yep.
But you were a fan. You've been an Alabama guy since the beginning. You've got a family tie. It's all legit. I'm normally very critical of fandoms. There's very specific rules on when you can and can't become a fan, and you pass the test.
Right.
You know, you scheduled your wedding 11 years ago. That was pre-Saban, right?
It was his first year.
So there you go.
Yeah. So let's see if the Falcons and the Titans will pass a test. A test of 1-2s on Sunday, Mercedes-Benz Stadium. And here we go again, boys. Every time we think the Titans are dead, every time they're an underdog, every time they're on the road, we get ready to write them off. They rise back up. They play their best when their back is against the wall. I got to believe the Falcons will have their best effort on Sundays. I'm done predicting games. I'm out of the prediction business when it comes to the Titans. But this feels like as close to a must-win in the first quarter of the season as you could ask for.
Well, yeah, I think it's a must-win from this standpoint. It's not to say they can't do it after falling 1-3, and I'm not saying they can't make it to the playoffs, because we saw in Indy last year and what they did in their start, and they ended up making the playoffs. But there was differences between Indy's 1-4, somewhere around their start, and the Tennessee Titans.
Yeah, 1-5.
Potential 1-3 start. Well, Indy had only lost one game within the division. The Titans have already lost two games within the division. And they can't afford, while Indy's winning, Houston's winning, seems like Jacksonville has this resurgence, so to speak. They can't afford to drop another game, whether it be in the division or outside of the division, in the conference or outside of the conference, because I think those games will come back and bite you, because the whole NFC, the AFC South, plays the same, division each and every year. So you can't afford to lose to Atlanta and then Indy or somebody else come back and they beat Atlanta or they beat someone else. You got to stay on pace with the other teams in your division. You got to stay on pace with Indy and Houston. So it's a must win, not from the standpoint of me saying, oh, if they don't win, they're out of the playoffs. No, they just got to keep pace in the AFC, period. You know, it's hard to come back from a 1-3 deficit and you've lost two games in your division.
And also think about the psyche of the fan base. If this team loses, falls to 1-3, some Titans fans might be so disgusted, start checking out. But on the flip side, you win, you're 2-2, you get your stud left tackle back, you kind of managed and navigated the first quarter of the season, and there's reason to believe.
Yeah, it's weird how much you can hang on one game, right? If you were to tell all of us when the day the suspension broke for Taylor Lewan, who, by the way, it's okay to ask if he's let his team down, by the way. I think that's a fair question. If you had told everybody the day that suspension came down that they're going to be 2-2 when he comes back, I think everybody would have said okay. Now, I think most people would have assumed a win over an Andrew Luckless Colts and a win over a Jacksonville team that they've dominated who had a rookie quarterback and Nick Foles injured. You know, if we had laid out all the scenarios and we said, oh, you're going to lose to Cleveland, lose to Atlanta, beat the two division teams, be 2-2, be 2-0 in the division, I think most everybody would have said, hell yeah, give it to me. But you may win the wrong two games in this four. Now, 2-2 without Lawan, I still think is pretty good. The problem is when you add nuance to it and dive deeper, the offensive line issues are not going to be solved by one player. And it may get better. It should get better. It will get better. But is it going to be good enough to win enough games to compete for the division title? I don't see how one guy fixes that many problems. But 2-2, I still think you sign up for. If I told you Lawan's going to be hurt and you're going to be eat dead even 2-2 heading into week 5, I think you take it. You didn't want it this particular way with two losses in the division, which means you got an uphill battle.
Stylistically, how do you think they go about this game? Because it feels like they can score some points against a Falcons defense that is a little undersized. It feels like, you know, maybe Tennessee can establish Derrick Henry and pound away against a smaller Atlanta defense that kind of resembles Seattle with Dan Quinn from 6 years ago, minus the elite level defense. They're not a good defense, but they're put together similarly to play in space. Does Arthur Smith, Mike Vrabel, and the Titans want to get into a back and forth against a team that has trouble stopping people, or do you want to ground and pound and make this thing ugly?
I mean, do you want to try to keep that offense off the field? Because the more times they get an opportunity to run plays, I think the better Atlanta's offense is. So you keep them on the sideline, and you do that by controlling the clock, time management, running the football with Derrick Henry. Atlanta hasn't proven they can stop the run. Yes, Dan Quinn has this fast defense, but they're not aggressive. Yes, he did come from Seattle, but this is no way, no shape, no form Seattle's defense. It would be if they had the mentality of a Seattle defense, but this defense doesn't have that mentality. So if I'm the Tennessee Titans, teams have had success running the football against the Atlanta Falcons. I am running a football to set up the run, and I'm going to run it until they prove undoubtedly they can stop it. And I don't think that's the case. So the way you beat them is you control the clock and you keep that high-powered offense with those three very good receivers on the bench, because they can't score no points if they're sitting down.
Yeah, I think also this team has not been good in the first half, Atlanta. They've been punched in the face a few times. They've come back from that obviously once, but they've outscored 41-3 in their two road games. On this is obviously a home game. You know, they have the 12th rated rush defense in the league. The Falcons do. That's significantly better than the Titans. The problem is the Titans don't the Falcons don't run the ball at all. 27th in the league in rushing. They have not been able to get the running game going. Tevin Coleman now out of there, not a part of that team. You know, the offensive line, again, I hate to oversimplify this, but I think it does come back to the offensive line. Matt Ryan right now is being sacked at one of the lowest percentages of any quarterback in the NFL, meaning he's protected. Marcus is the most sacked quarterback in the NFL through 3 weeks, so he's not being protected. Which one can run the ball and protect the quarterback? I know that sounds super easy, like an oversimplified equation, but it's just if they protect the quarterback and run the football, I think the Titans win.
But this could be the difference, too.
I think they're going to be more physical.
Marcus has yet to throw an interception. Matt Ryan has 6 interceptions, I believe, on the season. He had 7 all of last year. One of the MOs of Matt Ryan over the course of maybe the last 4 or 5 years is some of the turnovers that happen inside the red zone. I feel like if D&P's defense can turn them over, great chance to win this game.
Yeah, they're 28th in the NFL with 7 turnovers already through 3 games. Titans are first in the NFL with just the 1 turnover. So Titans have been far better at protecting the football. Here's the other thing. The Falcons have 0 rushing touchdowns on the season. They have not had a rushing touchdown yet. So 74 yards a game rushing, that's nothing. That's pathetic. So, again, they've protected the quarterback very well, and that's why he's averaging almost 300 yards passing, and they got all those stud receivers. So you got to account for that. I just think if you're going to go at a Dean Pease defense one-dimensionally, he's going to have a plan for you. Like, I don't know what that may be. I don't know if there's individual matchups that the Titans can win against Calvin Ridley and Julio Jones. But with Logan Ryan and Kevin Byard and Dean Pease calling the plays, and you're going to come at Dean Pease with a one-dimensional offense, I'm going to lean on Dean Pease to win that battle every single time. So I think I actually like the Titans in this matchup. Again, I'm with you. I'm not in the prediction business anymore. I think both teams are going to be angry. I think the Titans' physicality could be the difference. They don't mind playing a dirty, you know, run the football, play defense, get after the quarterback style of game, and that, you know, that I think is how you can beat the Falcons. You line up, you hit them in the mouth right in the beginning, you force turnovers. They're not, you know, they're the most penalized team in the NFL. The Falcons are. There's some sloppiness to the Falcons that if you line up and hit them, I think you can capitalize. So I actually like the Titans to play really, really well on Sunday.
I mean, it's hard to sort of predict this game and how it will go. Because if the Titans stick to, I think, who they are, the MO, then you know, they give themselves a better shot on the road at winning this game. Atlanta has given up, you know, 100 yards to Dalvin Cook and almost 100 yards to Marlon Mack. Marlon Mack averaged over 4 yards a carry. Dalvin Cook averaged over 4 yards a carry. Then they play Philadelphia in a minute. We know Philly really don't like to run the football as much. But against two teams that rely on the run heavy, they haven't been good. So if I'm the Tennessee Titans and I'm looking at that, I am running the football with Derrick Henry. I am going to line up and dare Atlanta to stop it. I think after a while they're going to get tired of tackling Derrick Henry. And Derrick Henry has proven, listen, he's averaging over 4 yards a carry. This guy is the offense. If they run the offense through Derrick Henry, they will be a much better team. His career says that. He's a 4 yard per carry guy. You give him the ball twice on average, he's going to get you close to a first down. Especially if you give them the ball the later the game gets, he gets stronger, or they just don't want to tackle him. So you go down to Atlanta in Mercedes-Benz Dome, and you run the football. You keep the crowd quiet. You control the clock. You keep that high-powered offense off the field.
All right, Titans fans, let's hear from you. 615-737-1025, 737-1025. What do you make of the matchup on Sunday, Falcons and Titans in Atlanta? What is your prediction? And what happens if this team, A, wins the game, gets to 2-2, loses, falls to 1-3? Feels like a major difference in Sunday's outcome for the way you view the rest of the season. 737-1025, hour 2 next here on Morning Drive.